and had promptly announced that she was going to come too, in case Cohen wanted anything rubbed. Rincewind was vaguely aware of some sort of chemistry bubbling away. For one thing, Cohen had made an effort to comb his beard. "I think she's rather taken with you," he said. Cohen sighed.
"If I was 20 years younger," he said wistfully.
"Yes?"
"I'd be 67.
"What's that got to do with it?"
"Well, how can I put it? When I was a young man, carving my name in the world, well, then I liked my women red-haired and fiery."
"Oh."
"And then I grew a little older, and for preference I looked for a woman with blonde hair and the glint of the world in her eye."
"Oh, yes."
"But then I grew a little older again, and I came to see the point of dark women of a sultry nature."
He paused. Rincewind waited. "And," he said, "then what? What is it that you look for in a woman now?" Cohen turned one rheumy blue eye on him.
"Patience," he said.
"I can't believe it," said a voice behind them. "Me riding with Cohen the Barbarian."
It was Two Flower. Since early morning he had been like a monkey with a key to the banana plantation after discovering he was breathing the same air as the greatest hero of all time.
"Is he perhaps being sarcastic?" said Cohen to Rincewind.
"No, he's always like that." Cohen turned in his saddle. Two Flower beamed at him and waved proudly. Cohen turned back and grunted.
"He's got eyes, isn't he?"
"Yes, but they don't work like other people's. Take it from me. I mean, well, you know the horse people's yurt where we were last night?"
"Yes."
"Would you say it was a bit dark and greasy and smelt like a very ill horse?"
"Very accurate description, I'd say."
"He wouldn't agree. He'd say it was a magnificent barbarian tent, hung with the pelts of the great beasts hunted by the lean-eyed warriors from the edge of civilization, and smelt of the rare and curious resins plundered from the caravans as they crossed the trackless... well, and so on. I mean it," he added.
"He's mad?"
"Sort of mad, but mad with lots of money."
"Oh, then he can't be mad. I've been around. If a man has lots of money, he's just eccentric."
Cohen turned in his saddle again. Two Flower was telling Bethan how Cohen had single-handedly defeated the snake warriors of the witch lord of Subalinda and stolen the sacred diamond from the giant statue of Ofla, the crocodile god. A weird smile formed among the wrinkles of Cohen's face. "I could tell him to shut up if you like," said Rincewind.
"Would he?"
"Nah, not really."
"Let him babble," said Cohen.
His hand fell to the handle of his sword, polished smooth by the grip of decades.
"Anyway, I like his eyes," he said. "They can see for 50 years.
100 yards behind them, hopping rather awkwardly through the soft snow, came the luggage. No one ever asked its opinion about anything. By evening, they had come to the edge of the high plains, and rode down through gloomy pine forests that had only been lightly dusted by the snowstorm. It was a landscape of huge cracked rocks, and valleys so narrow and deep that the days only lasted about 20 minutes. A wild, windy country, the sort where you might expect to find...
"Trolls,"
said Cohen, sniffing the air. Rincewind stared around him in the red evening light. Suddenly... rocks that had seemed perfectly normal looked suspiciously alive. Shadows that he wouldn't have looked at twice now began to look horribly occupied.
"I like trolls," said Two Flower.
"No, you don't," said Rincewind firmly. "You can't. They're big and knobbly, and they eat people."
"No, they don't," said Cohen, sliding awkwardly off his horse and massaging his knees. "Well-known misapprehension, that is. Trolls never ate anybody."
"No?"
"No. They always spit the bits out. Can't digest people, you see. Your average troll don't want any more out of life than a nice lump of granite. Maybe with perhaps a nice slab of limestone for afters. I heard someone say it's because they're a silicate...
Cohen paused and wiped his beard.
"Made out of rocks.
Rincewind nodded. Trolls were not unknown in Ankh-Morpork, of course, where they often got employment as bodyguards. They tended to be a bit expensive to keep, until they learned about doors and didn't simply leave the house by walking aimlessly through the nearest wall. As they gathered firewood, Cohen went on.
"Trolls' teeth. That's the things."
"Why?" said Bethan.
"Diamonds. Got to be, you see. Only thing that can stand the rocks. And they still have to grow a new set every year."
"Talking of teeth," said Twoflower.
"Yes?"
"I can't help noticing..."
"Yes?"
"Oh, nothing," said Twoflower.
"Yes? Oh, let's get this fire going before we lose the light. And then..."
Cohen's face fell.
"I suppose we'd better make some soup."
"Rincewind's good at that," said Twoflower enthusiastically. "He knows all about herbs and roots and things." Cohen gave Rincewind a look which suggested that he, Cohen, didn't believe that.
"Well, the horse people gave us some horse jerky," he said. "If you can find some wild onions and stuff, it might make it taste better."
"But I..." Rincewind began and gave up. "Anyway," he reasoned, "I know what an onion looks like. It's a sort of saggy white thing with a green bit sticking out of the top. Should be fairly conspicuous." "I'll just go and have a look, shall I?" he said.
"Yes."
"Over there, in all that thick, shadowy undergrowth?"
"Very good place, yes."
"Where all the deep gullies and things are, you mean?"
"Ideal spot, I'd say."
"Yes, I thought so," said Rincewind bitterly. He set off wondering how you attracted onions. After all, he thought, although you see them hanging in ropes on market stalls, they probably don't grow like that. Perhaps peasants or whatever use onion hounds or something, or sing songs to attract onions. There were a few early stars out as he started to poke aimlessly among the leaves and grass. Luminous fungi, unpleasantly organic, and looking like marital aids for gnomes, squished under his feet. Small flying things bit him. Other things, fortunately invisible, hopped or slithered away under the bushes and croaked reproachfully at him.
"Onions?" whispered Rincewind. "Any onions here?"
"There's a patch of them by that old yew tree," said a voice beside him.
"Ah," said Rincewind, "good." There was a long silence except for the buzzing of mosquitoes around Rincewind's ears. He was standing perfectly still. He hadn't even moved his eyes. Eventually he said,
"Excuse me."
"Yes?"
"Which one's the yew?"
"Small, gnarly one with the little dark green needles."
"Oh, yes, I see. Thanks again."
He didn't move. Eventually the voice said, conversationally,
"Anything more I can do for you?"
"You're not a tree, are you?" said Rincewind, still staring straight ahead.
"Don't be silly. Trees can't talk."
"Sorry. It's just that I've been having a bit of difficulty with trees lately. You know how it is."
"Not really. I'm a rock."
Rincewind's voice hardly changed. "Fine, fine," he said slowly. "Well, I'll just be getting those onions, then."
"Enjoy them."
He walked forward in a careful and dignified fashion, spotted a clump of stringy white things huddling in the undergrowth, uprooted them carefully, and turned round. There was a rock a little way away. But there were rocks everywhere. The very bones of the disk were near the surface here. He looked hard at the yew tree, just in case it had been speaking. But the yew, being a fairly solitary tree, hadn't heard about Rincewind the arboreal saviour, and in any case was asleep.
"If that was you, Twoflower, I knew it was you all along," said Rincewind.
His voice sounded suddenly clear and very alone in the gathering dusk. Rincewind remembered the only fact he knew for sure about trolls, which was that they turned into stone when exposed to sunlight, so that anyone who employed trolls to work during daylight had to spend a fortune in barrier cream. But now that he came to think about it, it didn't say anywhere what happened to them after the sun had gone down again. The last of the daylight trickled out of the landscape. And there suddenly seemed to be a great many rocks about. "'He's an awful long time with those onions,' said Two Flower. "'Do you think we'd better go and look for him?'
"'Wizards know how to look after themselves,' said Cohen. "'Don't worry.'
He winced. Bethan was cutting his toenails.
"'He's not a terribly good wizard, actually,' said Two Flower, drawing nearer the fire. "'I wouldn't say this to his face, but—'
He leaned towards Cohen.
"'I've never actually seen him do any magic.'
"'Right, let's have the other one,' said Bethan.
"'She's very kind of you.
"'You'd have quite nice feet if only you'd look after them.'
"'I can't seem to bend down like I used to,'
said Cohen sheepishly.
"'Of course you don't get to meet many chiropodists in my line of work. "'Funny, really. "'I've met any amount of snake priests, mad gods, warlords. "'Never any chiropodists. "'I suppose it wouldn't look too right, really.' "'Cohen against the chiropodists?'
"'Or Cohen and the chiropractors of doom,' suggested Bethan.
Cohen cackled.
"'Or Cohen and the mad dentists,'
laughed Two Flower. Cohen's mouth snapped shut.
"'What's so funny about that?'
he asked, and his voice had knuckles in it.
"'Oh, well,' said Two Flower, "'your teeth, you see.'
"'What about them?'
snapped Cohen. Two Flower swallowed.
"'I can't help noticing that they're, not in the same geographical location as your mouth.'
Cohen glared at him. Then he sagged, and looked very small and old.
"'True, of course,'
he muttered.
"'I don't blame you. It's hard to be a hero with no teeth. It don't matter what else you lose. You can get by with one eye, even.' "'But you show him a mouth full of gums, and no one has any respect.'
"'I do,' said Bethan, loyally.
"'Why don't you get some more?' said Two Flower, brightly.
"'Yes, well, if I was a shark or something, yes, I'd grow some,'
said Cohen, sarcastically.
"'Oh, no, you buy them,' said Two Flower. "'Look, I'll show you. Bethan, do you mind looking the other way?'
He waited until she'd turned around, and then he put his hand to his mouth.
"'You see?'
he said. Bethan heard Cohen gasp.
"'You can take yours out?'
"'Oh, yes. I've got several sets. Excuse me.'
There was a swallowing noise, and then, in a more normal voice, Two Flower said, "'It's very convenient, of course.' Cohen's very voice radiated awe, or as much awe as is possible without teeth, which is about the same amount as with teeth, but sounds a great deal less impressive.
"'I should think so,' he said. "'When they ache, you just take them out and let them get on with it, yes? "'Teach the little buggers a lesson. "'See how they like being left to ache all by themselves.'
"'That's not quite right,' said Two Flower carefully. "'They're not mine. They just belong to me.'
"'You put someone else's teeth in your mouth?'
"'No, someone made them.' "'Lots of people wear them where I come from. It's, But Two Flower's lecture on dental appliances went ungiven because somebody hit him. The disk's little moon toiled across the sky. It shone by its own light, owing to the cramped and rather inefficient astronomical arrangements made by the Creator, and was quite crowded with assorted lunar goddesses, who were not at this particular time paying much attention to what went on in the disk, but were getting up a petition about the ice giants. Had they looked down, they would have seen Rincewind talking urgently to a bunch of rocks. Trolls are one of the oldest life forms in the multiverse, dating from an early attempt to get the whole life thing on the road without all that squashy protoplasm. Individual trolls live for a long time, hibernating during the summertime and sleeping during the day, since heat affects them and makes them slow. They have a fascinating geology. One could talk about tribology, one could mention the semiconductor effects of impure silicon, one could talk about the giant trolls of prehistory who made up most of the disk's major mountain ranges and will cause some real problems if they ever awake. But the plain fact is that without the disk's powerful and pervasive magical field, trolls would have died out a long time ago. Psychiatry hadn't been invented on the disk. No one had ever shoved an ink blot under Rincewind's nose to see if he had any loose toys in the attic. So the only way he'd have been able to describe the rocks turning back into trolls was by gabbling vaguely about how pictures suddenly form when you look at the fire, or clouds. One minute there'd be a perfectly ordinary rock, and suddenly a few cracks that had been there all along took on the definite appearance of a mouth, or a pointed ear. A moment later, and without anything actually changing at all, a troll would be sitting there, grinning at him with a mouthful of diamonds. "They wouldn't be able to digest me," he told himself. "I'd make them awfully ill." It wasn't much of a comfort.
"So, you're Rincewind the Wizard?"
said the nearest one. It sounded like someone running over gravel.
"I dunno. I thought you'd be taller." "Perhaps he's eroded a bit," said another one. "The legend is awfully old."
Rincewind shifted awkwardly. He was pretty certain the rock he was sitting on was changing shape, and a tiny troll, hardly any more than a pebble, was sitting companionably on his foot and watching him with extreme interest.
Legend, he said. "What legend?"
"It's been handed down from mountain to gravel since the sunset of time," said the first troll.
An interesting metaphor. To nocturnal trolls, of course, the dawn of time lies in the future.
"When the red star lights the sky, Rincewind the Wizard will come looking for onions. Do not bite him. It is very important that you help him stay alive."
There was a pause.
"That's it," said Rincewind.
"Yes,"
said the troll. "We've always been puzzled about it. Most of our legends are much more exciting. It was more interesting being a rock in the old days." "It was," said Rincewind weakly.
"Oh, yes, no end of fun. Volcanoes all over the place. It really meant something being a rock then. There was none of the sedimentary nonsense. You were igneous or nothing. Of course, that's all gone now. People call themselves trolls today. Well, sometimes they're hardly more than slate. Chalk, even. I wouldn't give myself airs if you could use me to draw with. Would you?"
"No," said Rincewind quickly. "Absolutely not, no. This, legend thing. It said you shouldn't bite me."
"That's right," said the little troll on his foot. "And it was me who told you where the onions were."
"We're rather glad you came along," said the first troll, which Rincewind couldn't help noticing was the biggest one there.
"We're a bit worried about this new star. What does it mean?"
"I don't know," said Rincewind. "Everyone seems to think I know about it, but I don't."
"It's not that we would mind being melted down," said the big troll. "That's how we all started, anyway. But we thought maybe it might mean the end of everything, and that doesn't seem a very good thing."
"It's getting bigger," said another troll. "Look at it now. It's bigger than last night."
Rincewind looked. It was definitely bigger than last night.
"So we thought you might have some suggestions," said the head troll, as meekly as it is possible to sound, with a voice like a granite gargle.
"You could jump over the edge," said Rincewind. "There must be lots of places in the universe that could do with some extra rocks."
"We've heard about that," said the troll. "We've met rocks that tried it. They say you float about for millions of years, and then you get very hot and burn away and end up at the bottom of a big hole in the scenery. That doesn't sound very bright."
It stood up with a noise like coal rattling down a chute, and stretched its thick, knobbly arms.
"Well, we're supposed to help you," it said. "Anything you want doing?"
"I was supposed to be making some soup," said Rincewind.
He waved the onions vaguely. It was probably not the most heroic or purposeful gesture ever made.
"Soup?" said the troll. "Is that all?"
"Well, maybe some biscuits too."
The trolls looked at one another, exposing enough mouth jewellery to buy a medium-sized city. Eventually the biggest troll said,
"Soup it is, then."
It shrugged grittily.
"It's just that we imagined that the legend would, well, be a little more, I don't know, somehow I thought, still, I expect it doesn't matter."
It extended its hand like a bunch of fossil bananas.
"I'm quartz," it said. "That's chrysoprase over there, and breccia, and jasper, and my wife Beryl. She's a bit metamorphic, but who isn't these days? Jasper, get off his foot."
Rincewind took the hand gingerly, bracing himself for the crunch of crushed bone. It didn't come. The troll's hand was rough and a bit lichenous around the fingernails.
"I'm sorry," said Rincewind. "I never really met trolls before."
"We're a dying race," said Quart, sadly,
as the party set off under the stars.
"Young Jasper's the only pebble in our tribe. We suffer from philosophy, you know."
"Yes," said Rincewind, trying to keep up.
The troll band moved very quickly, but also very quietly. Big, round shapes moving like wraiths through the night. Only the occasional flat squeak of a night creature who hadn't heard them approaching marked their passage.
"Oh, yes. Martyrs to it. It comes to all of us in the end. One evening, they say, you start to wake up, and then you think, why bother? And you just don't. See those boulders over there?"
Rincewind saw some huge shapes lying in the grass.
"The one on the end's my aunt. I don't know what she's thinking about, but she hasn't moved for 200 years.
"Gosh, I'm sorry."
"Oh, it's no problem with us around to look after them," said Quartz. "Not many humans around here, you see. I know it's not your fault, but you don't seem to be able to spot the difference between a thinking troll and an ordinary rock. My great-uncle was actually quarried, you know."
"Oh, that's terrible."
"Yes. One minute he was a troll, and the next he was an ornamental fireplace."
They paused in front of a familiar-looking cliff. The scuffed remains of a fire smouldered in the darkness.
"It looks like there's been a fight," said Beryl.
"They're all gone," said Rincewind. He ran to the end of the clearing. "The horses, too. Even the luggage."
"One of them's leaked," said Quartz, kneeling down. "The red watery stuff you have in your insides, look."
"Blood.
Is that what it's called? I've never really seen the point of it."
Rincewind scuttled about in the manner of one totally at his wit's end, peering behind bushes in case anyone was hiding there. That was why he tripped over a small green bottle.
"Cohen's liniment," he moaned. "He never goes anywhere without it."
"Well," said Quartz, "you humans have something you can do. I mean, like when we slow right down and catch philosophy. Only you just fall to bits."
"Dying, it's cold," screamed Rincewind.
"That's it. They haven't done that because they're not here."
"Unless they were eaten," suggested Jasper excitedly.
"Hmm," said Quartz. "And
wolves?" said Rincewind.
"Yeah, we flattened all the wolves around here years ago," said the troll. "Old Grandad did, anyway."
"He didn't like them?"
"No, he just didn't used to look where he was going."
The trolls looked at the ground again.
"There's a trail," he said. "Quite a lot of horses."
He looked up at the nearby hills where sheer cliffs and dangerous crags loomed over the moonlit forests.
"Old Grandad lives up there," he said quietly.
There was something about the way he said it that made Rincewind decide that he didn't ever want to meet old Grandad.
"Dangerous, is he?" he ventured.
"He's very old and big and mean. We haven't seen him about for years," said Quartz.
"Centuries," corrected Beryl.
"He'll squash 'em all flat," added Jasper, jumping up and down on Rincewind's toes.
"It just happens sometimes that a really old and big troll will go off by himself into the hills and
the rock takes over, if you follow me."
"No,"
Quartz sighed.
"People sometimes act like animals, don't they? And sometimes a troll will start thinking like a rock. And rocks don't like people much."
Breccia, a skinny troll with a sandstone finish, rapped on Quartz's shoulder.
"Are we going to follow them, then?" he said. "The legend says we should help this Rincewind squashy."
Quartz stood up, thought for a moment, then picked Rincewind up by the scruff of his neck and with a big, gritty movement, placed him on his shoulders.
"We go,"
he said firmly.
"If we meet old Grandad, I'll try and explain."
Two miles away, a string of horses trotted through the night. Three of them carried captives, expertly gagged and bound. A fourth pulled a rough travois, on which the luggage lay trussed and netted and silent. Herena softly called the column to a halt and beckoned one of her men to her.
"Are you quite sure?" she said.
I can't hear anything. I saw troll shapes, he said flatly. She looked around. The trees had thinned out here. There was a lot of scree, and ahead of them the track led towards a bald, rocky hill that looked especially unpleasant by red starlight. She was worried about the track. It was extremely old, but something had made it, and trolls took a lot of killing. She sighed. Suddenly, it looked as though that secretarial career was not such a bad option at that. Not for the first time, she reflected that there were many drawbacks to being a swordswoman, not least of which was that men didn't take you seriously until you'd actually killed them, by which time it didn't really matter anyway. Then there was all the leather, which brought her out in a rash, but seemed to be unbreakably traditional. And then there was the ale. It was all right for the likes of Hrun the Barbarian or Simbar the Assassin to carouse all night in low bars, but Herenna drew the line at it unless they sold proper drinks in small glasses, preferably with a cherry in. And as for the toilet facilities. But she was too big to be a thief, too honest to be an assassin, too intelligent to be a wife, and too proud to enter the only other female profession generally available. So she'd become a swordswoman, and had been a good one, amassing a modest fortune that she was carefully husbanding for a future that she hadn't quite worked out yet, but which would certainly include a B-day, if she had anything to say about it. There was a distant sound of splintering timber. Trolls had never seen the point of walking around trees. She looked up at the hill again. Two arms of high ground swept away to right and left, and up ahead was a large outcrop with, she squinted, some caves in it? Troll caves. But maybe a better option than blundering around at night, and come sun up, there'd be no problem. She leaned across to Gunsir, leader of the gang of Moorpork mercenaries. She wasn't very happy about him. It was true that he had the muscles of an ox, and the stamina of an ox. The trouble was that he seemed to have the brain of an ox as well, and the viciousness of a ferret. Like most of the lads in downtown Moorpork, he'd have cheerfully sold his granny for glue, and probably had.
"We'll head for the caves and light a big fire in the entrance," she said. "Trolls don't like fire."
He gave her a look which suggested he had his own ideas about who should be giving the orders. But his lips said,
"You're the boss?"
"Right." Herenna looked back at the three captives. That was the box, all right. Trumon's description had been absolutely accurate. But neither of the men looked like a wizard. Not even a failed wizard.
"Oh, dear," said Quartz.
The trolls halted. The night closed in like velvet. An owl hooted eerily. At least Rincewind assumed it was an owl. He was a little hazy on ornithology. Perhaps a nightingale hooted, unless it was a thrush. A bat flittered overhead. He was quite confident about that. He was also very tired and quite bruised. "Why, oh dear," he said. He peered into the gloom. There was a distant speck in the hills that might have been a fire. "Oh," he said, "you don't like fires, do you?" Quartz nodded.
"It destroys the superconductivity of our brains," he said. "But a fire that small wouldn't have much effect on old Grandad."
Rincewind looked around cautiously, listening for the sound of a rogue troll. He'd seen what normal trolls could do to a forest. They weren't naturally destructive, they just treated organic matter as a sort of inconvenient fog.
"Let's hope he doesn't find it then," he said fervently.
Quartz sighed.
"Not much chance of that," he said. "They've lit it in his mouth."
"It's a judgment on me,"
moaned Cohen. He tugged ineffectually at his bonds. Twoflower peered at him muzzily. Gansia's slingshot had raised quite a lump on the back of his head, and he was a little uncertain about things, starting with his name and working upwards.
"I should have been listening out," said Cohen. "I should have been paying attention and not being swayed by all this talk about your washer names, your din-chewers. I must be getting soft."
He levered himself up by his elbows. Herenna and the rest of the gang were standing around the fire in the cave mouth. The luggage was still and silent under its net in a corner.
"There's something funny about this cave," said Bethan.
"What?"
said Cohen.
"Well, look at it. Have you ever seen rocks like those before?"
Cohen had to agree that the semicircle of stones around the cave entrance were unusual. Each one was higher than a man, and heavily worn, and surprisingly shiny. There was a matching semicircle on the ceiling. The whole effect was that of a stone computer, built by a druid, with a vague idea of geometry and no sense of gravity. "Look at the walls, too." Cohen squinted at the wall next to him. There were veins of red crystal in it. He couldn't be quite certain, but it was almost as if little points of light kept flashing on and off deep within the rock itself. It was also extremely draughty. A steady breeze blew out of the black depths of the cave.
"I'm sure it was blowing the other way when we came in," whispered Bethan. "What do you think, Twoflower?"
"Well, I'm not a cave expert," he said, "but I was just thinking that's a very interesting stalag thingy hanging from the ceiling up there. Sort of bulbous, isn't it?" They looked at it.
"I can't quite put my finger on why," said Twoflower, "but I think it might be rather a good idea to get out of here." "Oh, yes," said Cohen sarcastically. "I suppose we just better ask these people to untie us and let us go, eh?"
Cohen hadn't spent much time in Twoflower's company, otherwise he would not have been surprised when the little man nodded brightly and said, in the loud, slow, and careful voice he employed as an alternative to actually speaking other people's languages,
"Excuse me, could you please untie us and let us go? It's rather damp and draughty in here. Sorry."
Bethan looked sidelong at Cohen.
Was he supposed to say that?
"It's novel, I grant you."
And indeed, three people detached themselves from the group around the fire and came towards them. They didn't look as if they intended to untie anyone. The two men, in fact, looked the sort of people who, when they see other people tied up, start playing around with knives and making greasy suggestions and leering a lot. Herena introduced herself by drawing her sword and pointing it at Twoflower's heart.
"Which one of you is Rincewind the Wizard?" she said. "There were four horses. Is he here?"
"I don't know where he is," said Twoflower. "He was looking for some onions."
"Then you are his friends, and he will come looking for you," said Herena. She glanced at Cohen and Bethan, then looked closely at the luggage.
Trumon had been emphatic that they shouldn't touch the luggage. Curiosity may have killed a cat, but Herena's curiosity could have massacred a pride of lions. She slit the netting and grasped the lid of the box. Twoflower winced.
"Locked," she said eventually. "Where is the key, fat one?"
It hasn't got a key," said Twoflower.
"There is a keyhole," she pointed out.
"Well, yes, but if it wants to stay locked, it stays locked," said Twoflower uncomfortably.
Herena was aware of Gansia's grin. She snarled.
"I want it open," she said. "Gansia, see to it."
She strode back to the fire. Gansia drew a long, thin knife and leaned down close to Twoflower's face.
"She wants it open," he said.
He looked up at the other man and grinned.
"She wants it open, Weems."
"Yeah."
Gansia waved the knife slowly in front of Twoflower's face.
"Look," said Twoflower patiently, "I don't think you understand. No one can open the luggage if it's feeling in a locked mood."
"Oh, yes, I forgot," said Gansia thoughtfully. "Of course, it's a magic box, isn't that right? With little legs, they say. I say, Weems, any legs your side? No?"
He held his knife to Twoflower's throat.
"I'm really upset about that," he said. "So's Weems. He doesn't say much, but what he does is, he tears bits off people. So, open the box."
He turned and planted a kick on the side of the box, leaving a nasty gash in the wood. There was a tiny little click. Gansia grinned. The lid swung up slowly, ponderously. The distant firelight gleamed off gold, lots of gold, in plate, chain and coin, heavy and glistening in the flickering shadows.
"All right," said Gansia softly.
He looked back at the unheeding men around the fire, who seemed to be shouting at someone outside the cave. Then he looked speculatively at Weems. His lips moved soundlessly with the unaccustomed effort of mental arithmetic.
he looked down at his knife. Then the floor moved.
"I heard someone," said one of the men, "down there, among the rocks."
Rincewind's voice floated up out of the darkness.
"I say,"
he said.
"Well," said Herenna.
"You're in great danger," shouted Rincewind. "You must put the fire out."
"No, no," said Herenna. "You've got it wrong. You are in great danger, and the fire stays."
"There's this big old troll."
"Everyone knows trolls keep away from fire," said Herenna.
She nodded. A couple of men drew their swords and slipped out into the darkness.
"Absolutely true," shouted Rincewind desperately. "Only this specific troll can't, you see."
"Can't?" Herenna hesitated. Something of the terror in Rincewind's voice hit her.
"Yes, because you see, you've lit it on his tongue."
Then the floor moved. Old Grandad awoke very slowly from his centuries-old slumber. He nearly didn't awake at all. In fact, a few decades later, none of this could have happened. When a troll gets old and starts to think seriously about the universe, it normally finds a quiet spot and gets down to some hard philosophizing, and after a while starts to forget about its extremities. It begins to crystallize around the edges until nothing remains except a tiny flicker of life inside quite a large hill with some unusual rock strata. Old Grandad hadn't got quite that far. He awoke from considering quite a promising line of inquiry about the meaning of truth, and found a hot, ashy taste in what, after a certain amount of thought, he remembered as being his mouth. He began to get angry. Commands skittered along neural pathways of impure silicon. Deep within his silicaceous body, stone slipped smoothly along special fracture lines. Trees toppled, turf split, as fingers the size of ships unfolded and gripped the ground. Two enormous rock slides high on his cliff face marked the opening of eyes like great crusted opals. Rincewind couldn't see all this, of course, since his own eyes were daylight issue only, but he did see the whole dark landscape shake itself slowly and then begin to rise impossibly against the stars. The sun rose. However, the sunlight didn't. What did happen was that the famous Discworld sunlight, which, as has already been indicated, travels very slowly through the disk's powerful magical field, sloshed gently over the lands around the rim and began its soft, silent battle against the retreating armies of the night. It poured like molten gold. Not precisely, of course. Trees didn't burst into flame, people didn't suddenly become very rich and extremely dead, and the seas didn't flash into steam. A better simile, in fact, would be not like molten gold across the sleeping landscape, bright, clean, and above all, slow. Herenna didn't hesitate. With great presence of mind, she ran to the edge of Old Grandad's bottom lip and jumped, rolling as she hit the earth. The men followed her, cursing as they landed among the debris. Like a fat man trying to do press-ups, the old troll pushed himself upwards. This wasn't apparent from where the prisoners were lying. All they knew was that the floor kept rolling under them, and that there was a lot of noise going on, most of it unpleasant. Weems grabbed Gansia's arm.
"It's a earthquake," he said. "Let's get out of here."
"Not without the gold," said Gansia.
"What? The gold? The gold? Man, we could be as rich as creosote."
Weems might have had a room temperature IQ, but he knew idiocy when he saw it. Gansia's eyes gleamed more than gold, and he appeared to be staring at Weems's left ear. Weems looked desperately at the luggage. It was still open, invitingly, which was odd. You'd have thought all the shaking would have slammed the lid shut.
"We'd never carry it," he suggested. "It's too heavy," he added.
"Well, damn, we'll carry some of it," shouted Gansia, and leapt towards the chest as the floor shook again.
The lid snapped shut. Gansia vanished. And just in case Weems thought it was accidental,
The luggage's lid snapped open again, just for a second, and a large tongue as red as mahogany licked across the broad teeth, as white as sycamore. Then it slammed shut again. To Weems's further horror, hundreds of little legs extruded from the underside of the box. It rose very deliberately, and carefully arranging its feet, shuffled around to face him. There was a particularly malevolent look about its keyhole. The sort of look that says, "Go on, make my day." He backed away and looked imploringly at Two Flower.
"I think it might be a good idea if you untied us," suggested Two Flower. "It's really quite friendly once it gets to know you."
Licking his lips nervously, Weems drew his knife. The luggage gave a warning creak. He slashed through their bonds and stood back quickly.
"Thank you," said Two Flower.
"I think my back's gone again,"
complained Cohen as Bethan helped him to his feet.
"What do we do with this man?" said Bethan.
"We take his knife and tell him to bugger off," said Cohen. "Right?"
"Yes, sir. Thank you, sir," said Weems, and bolted towards the cave mouth.
For a moment he was outlined against the grey pre-dawn sky, and then he vanished. There was a distant cry of, "Ah!" The sunlight roared silently across the land like surf. Here and there, where the magic field was slightly weaker, tongues of morning raced ahead of the day, leaving isolated islands of night that contracted and vanished as the bright ocean flowed onwards. The uplands around the vortex plains stood out ahead of the advancing tide like a great grey ship. It is possible to stab a troll, but the technique takes practice, and no one ever gets a chance to practice more than once. Herena's men saw the trolls loom out of the darkness like very solid ghosts. Blades shattered as they hit silica skins. There were one or two brief, flat screams, and then nothing more but shouts far away in the forest, as they put as much distance as they could between themselves and the avenging earth. Rincewind crept out from behind a tree and looked around. He was alone, but the bushes behind him rustled as the trolls lumbered up after the gang. He looked up. High above him, two great crystalline eyes focused in hatred of everything soft and squelchy, and above all warm. Rincewind cowered in horror as a hand the size of a house rose, curled into a fist, and dropped towards him. Day came with a silent explosion of light. For a moment the huge terrifying bulk of old Grandad was a breakwater of shadow as the daylight streamed past. There was a brief grinding noise. There was silence. Several minutes passed. Nothing happened. A few birds started singing. A bumblebee buzzed over the boulder that was old Grandad's fist and alighted on a patch of thyme that had grown under a stone fingernail. There was a scuffling down below. Rincewind slid awkwardly out of the narrow gap between the fist and the ground like a snake leaving a burrow. He lay on his back, staring up at the sky past the frozen shape of the troll. It hadn't changed in any way, apart from the stillness, but already the eye started to play tricks. Last night, Rincewind had looked at cracks in stone and seen them become mouths and eyes. Now he looked at the great cliff face and saw the features become, like magic, mere blemishes in the rock. "Wow," he said. That didn't seem to help. He stood up, dusted himself off, and looked around. Apart from the bumblebee, he was completely alone. After poking around for a bit, he found a rock that from certain angles looked like beryl. He was lost and lonely and a long way from home. There was a crunch high above him, and shards of rock spattered into the earth. High up on the face of old Grandad, a hole appeared. There was a brief sight of the luggage's backside as it struggled to regain its footing, and then Two Flower's head poked out of the mouth cave.
"Anyone down there? I say!"
"Hey!" shouted the wizard. "Am I glad to see you?"
"I don't know. Are you?" said Two Flower. "Am I what?" "Gosh, there's a wonderful view from up here!"
It took them half an hour to get down.
Fortunately, old Grandad had been quite craggy with plenty of handholds, but his nose would have presented a tricky obstacle if it hadn't been for the luxuriant oak tree that flourished in one nostril. The luggage didn't bother to climb. It just jumped and bounced its way down with no apparent harm. Cohen sat in the shade, trying to catch his breath and waiting for his sanity to catch up with him. He eyed the luggage thoughtfully. "The horses have all gone," said Two Flower.
"We'll find them," said Cohen.
His eyes bored into the luggage, which began to look embarrassed. "They were carrying all our food," said Rincewind.
"Plenty of food in the forests."
"I have some nourishing biscuits in the luggage," said Two Flower. "Travellers' digestives. Always a comfort in a tight spot." "I've tried them," said Rincewind. "They've got a mean edge on them," and Cohen stood up, wincing.
"Excuse me," he said flatly. "There's something I've got to know."
He walked over to the luggage and gripped its lid. The box backed away hurriedly, but Cohen stuck out a skinny foot and tripped up half its legs. As it twisted to snap at him, he gritted his teeth and heaved, jerking the luggage onto its curved lid, where it rocked angrily like a maddened tortoise.
"Hey, that's my luggage," said Two Flower. "Why is he attacking my luggage?"
"I think I know," said Bethan quietly. "I think it's because he's scared of it."
Two Flower turned to Rincewind, open-mouthed. Rincewind shrugged.
"Search me," he said. "I run away from things I'm scared of myself."
With a snap of its lid, the luggage jerked into the air and came down running, catching Cohen a crack on the shins with one of its brass corners. As it wheeled around, he got a grip on it just long enough to send it galloping full tilt into a rock.
"Not bad," said Rincewind, admiringly.
The luggage staggered back, paused for a moment, then came at Cohen, waving its lid menacingly. He jumped and landed on it, with both his hands and feet caught in the gap between the box and the lid. This severely puzzled the luggage. It was even more astonished when Cohen took a deep breath and heaved, muscles standing out on his skinny arms like a sock full of coconuts. They stood locked there for some time, tendon versus hinge. Occasionally one or other would creak. Bethan elbowed Two Flower in the ribs.
"Do something," she said.
Said Two Flower.
"Yes. That's about enough, I think. Put him down, please."
The luggage gave a creak of betrayal at the sound of its master's voice. Its lid flew up with such force that Cohen tumbled backwards, but he scrambled to his feet and flung himself towards the box. Its contents lay open to the skies. Cohen reached inside. The luggage creaked a bit, but it obviously weighed up the chances of being sent to the top of the great wardrobe in the sky. When Rincewind dared to peek through his fingers, Cohen was peering into the luggage and cursing under his breath.
"Laundry?" he shouted. "Is that it? Just laundry?"
He was shaking with rage.
"I think there's some biscuits, too," said Two Flower, in a small voice.
"But there was gold, and I saw it eat somebody."
Cohen looked imploringly at Rincewind.
The wizard sighed. "Don't ask me," he said. "I don't own the bloody thing."
"I bought it in a shop," said Two Flower defensively. "I said I wanted a travelling trunk."
"Well, that's what you got, all right," said Rincewind.
"It's very loyal," said Two Flower.
Yes, agreed Rincewind, "if loyalty is what you look for in a suitcase."
"Hold on," said Cohen, who had sagged onto a rock. "Was it one of those shops? I mean, I bet you hadn't noticed it before, and when you go back again it wasn't there."
Two Flower brightened.
"That's right.
Shopkeeper, a little wizened old guy, shop full of strange stuff."
"Exactly. Never could find it again. I thought I must have got the wrong street. Nothing but a brick wall where I thought it was. I remember thinking all the time it was rather..."
Cohen shrugged.
"One of those shops," he said.
No one knows why, but all the most truly mysterious and magical items are bought from shops that appear, and after a trading life even briefer than a double glazing company, vanish like smoke. There had been various attempts to explain this, all of which don't fully account for the observed facts. These shops turn up anywhere in the universe, and their immediate non-existence in any particular city can normally be deduced from crowds of people wandering the streets clutching defunct magical items, ornate guarantee cards, and looking very suspiciously at brick walls.
"That explains it, then."
He felt his back and grimaced.
"Bloody horse ran off with me liniment."
Rincewind remembered something and fumbled in the depths of his torn and now very grubby robe. He held up a green bottle.
"That's the stuff," said Cohen. "You're a marvel."
He looked sideways at Two Flower.
"I would have beaten it,"
he said quietly.
"Even if you hadn't called it off, I would have beaten it in the end."
"That's right,"
said Bethan.
"You two can make yourself useful,"
he added.
"That luggage broke through a troll tooth to get us out. That was Diamond. See if you can find the bitch. I've had an idea about them."
As Bethan rolled up her sleeves and uncorked the bottle, Rincewind took Two Flower to one side. When they were safely hidden behind a shrub, he said, "He's gone barmy." "That's Cohen the Barbarian you're talking about," said Two Flower, genuinely shocked. "He is the greatest warrior that was," said Rincewind urgently. "All that stuff with the warrior priests and man-eating zombies was years ago. All he's got now is memories and so many scars you could play noughts and crosses on him." "He is rather more elderly than I imagined, yes," said Two Flower. He picked up a fragment of diamond.
"So we ought to leave them and find our horses and move on," said Rincewind.
"That's a bit of a mean trick, isn't it?"
"They'll be all right," said Rincewind heartily. "The point is, would you feel happy in the company of someone who would attack the luggage with his bare hands?"
That is a point," said Two Flower. "They'll probably be better off without us anyway."
"Are you sure?"
"Positive,"
said Rincewind. They found the horses wandering aimlessly in the scrub, breakfasted on badly dried horse jerky, and set off in what Rincewind believed was the right direction. A few minutes later, the luggage emerged from the bushes and followed them. The sun rose higher in the sky, but still failed to blot out the light of the star.
"It's got bigger overnight," said Two Flower. "Why isn't anybody doing something?"
"Such as what?"
Two Flower thought. "Couldn't somebody tell Great Artuin to avoid it?" he said. "Sort of go around it?"
"That sort of thing has been tried before," said Rincewind. "Wizards tried to tune into Great Artuin's mind."
"It didn't work?"
"Oh, it worked all right," said Rincewind. Only there had been certain unforeseen risks in reading a mind as great as the world turtles, he explained. The wizards had trained up on tortoises and giant sea turtles first to get the hang of the Chelonian frame of mind, but although they knew that Great Artuin's mind would be big, they hadn't realized that it would be slow. "There's a bunch of wizards that have been reading it in shifts for 30 years, said Rincewind. "All they've found out is that Great Artuin is looking forward to something."
"What?"
"Who knows?"
They rode in silence for a while through a rough country where huge limestone blocks lined the track. Eventually Two Flower said, "We ought to go back, you know."
"Look, we'll reach the Smarl tomorrow," said Rincewind. "Nothing will happen to them out here. I don't see why..."
He was talking to himself. Two Flower had wheeled his horse and was trotting back, demonstrating all the horsemanship of a sack of potatoes. Rincewind looked down. The luggage regarded him owlishly.
"What you looking at?" said the wizard. "He can go back if he wants. Why should I bother?"
The luggage said nothing.
"Look, he's not my responsibility," said Rincewind. "Let's be absolutely clear about that."
The luggage said nothing, but louder this time.
"Go on, follow him. You're nothing to do with me."
The luggage retracted its little legs and settled down on the track.
"Well, I'm going," said Rincewind. "I mean it," he added.
He turned the horse's head back towards the new horizon and glanced down. The luggage sat there.
"It's no good trying to appeal to my better nature. You can stay here all day for all I care. I'm just going to ride off, okay?"
He glared at the luggage. The luggage looked back.
"I thought you'd come back,"
said Two Flower.
"I don't want to talk about it," said Rincewind.
"Shall we talk about something else?"
"Yeah. Well, discussing how to get these ropes off would be favourite," said Rincewind.
He wrenched at the bonds around his wrists.
"I can't imagine why you're so important,"
said Herenna. She sat on a rock opposite them, sword across her knees. Most of the gang lay among the rocks high above, watching the road. Rincewind and Two Flower had been a pathetically easy ambush.
"Weems told me what your box did to Gansier," she added. "I can't say that's a great loss, but I hope it understands that if it comes within a mile of us, I will personally cut both your throats. Yes?"
Rincewind nodded violently. Good, said Herenna. You're wanted dead or alive. I'm not really bothered which, but some of the lads might want to have a little discussion with you about those trolls. If the sun hadn't come up when it did. She left the words hanging and walked away. Well, here's another fine mess, said Rincewind. He had another pull at the ropes that bound him. There was a rock behind him, and if he could bring his wrists up. Yes, as he thought, it lacerated him while at the same time being too blunt to have any effect on the rope.
But why us? Said Twoflower. It's to do with that star, isn't it?
I don't know anything about the star, said Rincewind. I never even attended astrology lessons at the university.
I expect everything'll turn out all right in the end, said Twoflower.
Rincewind looked at him. Remarks like that always threw him.
Do you really believe that?
He said. I mean, really?
Well, things generally do work out satisfactorily when you come to think about it.
If you think the total disruption of my life for the last year is satisfactory, then you might be right. I've lost count of the times I've nearly been killed.
27, said Twoflower.
What?
27 times, said Twoflower helpfully. I worked it out. But you never actually have.
What? Worked it out? Said Rincewind, who was beginning to have the familiar feeling that the conversation had been mugged.
No, been killed. Doesn't that seem a bit, well, suspicious?
I've never objected to it, if that's what you mean, said Rincewind. He glared at his feet. Twoflower was right, of course. The spell was keeping him alive, it was obvious. No doubt if he jumped over a cliff, a passing cloud would cushion his fall. The trouble with that theory, he decided, was that it only worked if he didn't believe it was true. The moment he thought he was invulnerable, he'd be dead. So on the whole, it was wisest not to think about it at all. Anyway, he might be wrong. The only thing he could be certain of was that he was getting a headache. He hoped that the spell was somewhere in the area of the headache and really suffering. When they rode out of the hollow, both Rincewind and Twoflower were sharing a horse with one of their captors. Rincewind perched uncomfortably in front of Weems, who had sprained an ankle and was not in a good mood. Twoflower sat in front of Herenna, which, since he was fairly short, meant that at least he kept his ears warm. She rode with a drawn knife and a sharp eye out for any walking boxes. Herenna hadn't quite worked out what the luggage was, but she was bright enough to know that it wouldn't let Twoflower be killed. After about 10 minutes, they saw it in the middle of the road. Its lid lay open invitingly. It was full of gold.
Go round it, said Herenna.
But it's a trap.
That's right, said Weems, white-faced. You take it from me.
Reluctantly, they reined their horses around the glittering temptation and trotted on along the track. Weems glanced back fearfully, dreading to see the chest coming after him. What he saw was almost worse. It had gone. Far off to one side of the path, the long grass moved mysteriously and was still. Rincewind wasn't much of a wizard and even less of a fighter, but he was an expert at cowardice, and he knew fear when he smelt it. He said quietly,
"It'll follow you, you know."
"What?" said Weems, distractedly. He was still peering at the grass.
"It's very patient, and it never gives up. That's sapient pearwood you're dealing with. It'll let you think it's forgotten you, then one day you'll be walking along a dark street and you'll hear those little footsteps behind you. Schlup, 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 they'll go. Then you'll start running and they'll speed up. Schlup, 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 schlup.
Shut up!" shouted Weems. "It's probably already recognized you. So I said shut up!" Herenna turned round in her saddle and glared at them. Weems scowled and pulled Rincewind's ear until it was right in front of his mouth and said hoarsely,
"I'm afraid of nothing, understand? The wizard stuff, I spit on it."
"They all say that until they hear the footsteps," said Rincewind.
He stopped. A knife point was pricking his ribs. Nothing happened for the rest of the day, but to Rincewind's satisfaction and Weems' mounting paranoia, the luggage showed itself several times. Here it would be perched incongruously on a crag. There it would be half hidden in a ditch with moss growing over it. By late afternoon they came to the crest of a hill and looked down on the broad valley of the Upper Smarl, the longest river on the disk. It was already half a mile across, and heavy with the silt that made the lower valley the most fertile area on the continent. A few wisps of early mist wreathed its banks.
Schlup,
said Rincewind. He felt Weems jerk upright in the saddle.
Eh?
Just clearing my throat, said Rincewind, and grinned. He had put a lot of thought into that grin. It was the sort of grin people use when they stare at your left ear and tell you in an urgent tone of voice that they are being spied on by secret agents from the next galaxy. It was not a grin to inspire confidence. More horrible grins had probably been seen, but only on the sort of grinner that is orange with black stripes, has a long tail, and hangs around in jungles looking for victims to grin at. "Wipe that off," said Herenna, trotting up. Where the track led down to the river, there was a crude jetty and a big bronze gong. "It'll summon the ferryman," said Herenna. "If we cross here, we can cut off a big bend in the river. Might even make it to a town tonight." Weems looked doubtful. The sun was getting fat and red, and the mists were beginning to thicken. "Or maybe you want to spend the night this side of the water." Weems picked up the hammer and hit the gong so hard that it spun right round on its hanger and fell off. They waited in silence. Then, with a wet clinking sound, a chain sprang out of the water and pulled taut against an iron peg set into the bank. Eventually, the slow, flat shape of the ferry emerged from the mist, its hooded ferryman heaving on a big wheel set in its centre as he winched his way towards the shore. The ferry's flat bottom grated on the gravel, and the hooded figure leaned against the wheel, panting.
"Two at a time,"
it muttered.
"That's all. Just two with horses."
Rincewind swallowed and tried not to look at Two Flower. The man would probably be grinning and mugging like an idiot. He risked a sideways glance. Two Flower was sitting with his mouth open. "You are not the usual ferryman," said Herenna. "I've been here before. The usual man is a big fellow, sort of..."
"It's his day off."
"Oh. Well, okay," she said doubtfully. "In that case, what's he laughing at?" Two Flower's shoulders were shaking, his face had gone red, and he was emitting muffled snorts. Herenna glared at him, then looked hard at the ferryman. "Two of you, grab him." There was a pause, then one of the men said, "What, the ferryman?"
"Yes."
"Why?" Herenna looked blank. This sort of thing wasn't supposed to happen. It was accepted that when someone yelled something like, "Get him," or "Guards," people jumped to it. They weren't supposed to sit around discussing things.
"Because I said so,"
was the best she could manage. The two men nearest to the bowed figure looked at each other, shrugged, dismounted, and each took a shoulder. The ferryman was about half their size.
"Like this," said one of them.
Two Flower was choking for breath.
"Now I want to see what he's got under that robe."
The two men exchanged glances.
"I'm not sure that," said one.
He got no further because a knobbly elbow jerked into his stomach like a piston. His companion looked down incredulously and got the other elbow in his kidneys. Cohen cursed as he struggled to untangle his sword from his robe while hopping crabwise towards Herenna. Rincewind groaned, gritted his teeth, and jerked his head backwards hard. There was a scream from Weems, and Rincewind rolled sideways, landed heavily in the mud, scrambled up madly, and looked around for somewhere to hide. With a cry of triumph, Cohen managed to free his sword and waved it triumphantly, severely wounding a man who had been creeping up behind him. Herenna pushed Two Flower off her horse and fumbled for her own blade. Two Flower tried to stand up and caused the horse of another man to rear, throwing him off and bringing his head down onto the right level for Rincewind to kick it as hard as possible. Rincewind would be the first to call himself a rat, but even rats fight in a corner. Weems's hand dropped onto his shoulder, and a fist like a medium-sized rock slammed into his head. As he went down, he heard Herenna say, quite quietly, "Kill them both. I'll deal with this old fool."
"Right,"
said Weems, and turned towards Two Flower with his sword drawn. Rincewind saw him hesitate. There was a moment of silence, and then even Herenna could hear the splashing as the luggage surged ashore, water pouring from it. Weems stared at it in horror. His sword fell from his hand. He turned and ran into the mists. A moment later, the luggage bounded over Rincewind and followed him. Herenna lunged at Cohen, who parried the thrust and grunted as his arm twinged. The blades clanged wetly, and then Herenna was forced to back away as a cunning upward sweep from Cohen nearly disarmed her. Rincewind staggered towards Two Flower and tugged at him ineffectually. "Time to be going," he muttered.
"This is great," said Two Flower. "Did you see the way he..."
"Yes, yes, come on, but I want to... I say, well done!"
Herenna's sword spun out of her hand and stood quivering in the dirt. With a snort of satisfaction, Cohen brought his own sword back, went momentarily cross-eyed, gave a little yelp of pain, and stood absolutely motionless. Herenna looked at him, puzzled. She made an experimental move in the direction of her own sword, and when nothing happened, she grasped it, tested its balance, and stared at Cohen. Only his agonized eyes moved to follow her, as she circled him cautiously.
"His back's gone again,"
whispered Two Flower.
"What can we do?"
"We can see if we could catch the horses."
"Well," said Herenna,
"I don't know who you are or why you're here, and there's nothing personal about this, you understand." She raised her sword in both hands. There was a sudden movement in the mists, and the dull thud of a heavy piece of wood hitting a head. Herenna looked bewildered for a moment, and then fell forward. Bethan dropped the branch she had been holding and looked at Cohen. Then she grabbed him by the shoulders, stuck her knee in the small of his back, and gave a businesslike twist and let him go. An expression of bliss passed across his face. He gave an experimental bend.
"It's gone," he said. "The back. Gone."
Two Flower turned to Rincewind.
"My father used to recommend hanging from the top of a door," he said conversationally.
Weems crept very cautiously through the scrubby, mist-laden trees. The pale, damp air muffled all sounds, but he was certain that there had been nothing to hear for the past 10 minutes. He turned round very slowly, and then allowed himself the luxury of a long, heartfelt sigh. He stepped back into the cover of the bushes. Something nudged the back of his knees, very gently. Something angular. He looked down. There seemed to be more feet down there than there ought to be. And there was a short, sharp snap. The fire was a tiny dot of light in a dark landscape. The moon wasn't up yet, but the star was a lurking glow on the horizon.
"It's circular now," said Bethan. "It looks like a tiny sun. I'm sure it's getting hotter, too."
"Don't," said Rincewind, "as if I hadn't got enough to worry about."
"What I don't understand,"
said Cohen, who was having his back massaged,
"is how they captured you without us hearing it. We wouldn't have known at all if your luggage hadn't kept jumping up and down."
"And whining," said Bethan. They all looked at her.
"Well, it looked as if it was whining," she said. "I think it's rather sweet, really."
4 pairs of eyes turned towards the luggage, which was squatting on the other side of the fire. It got up and very pointedly moved back into the shadows.
"Easy to feed," said Cohen.
"Hard to lose," agreed Rincewind.
"Loyal," suggested Two Flower. "Roomy," said Cohen.
"But I wouldn't say sweet," said Rincewind.
"I suppose you wouldn't want to shell it," said Cohen.
Two Flower shook his head.
"I don't think it would understand," he said. "Nah, I suppose not," said Cohen.
He sat up and bit his lip.
"I was looking for a present for Bethan, you see. We're getting married."
"We thought you ought to be the first to know," said Bethan, and blushed. Rincewind didn't catch Two Flower's eye.
"Well, that's Just as soon as we find a town where there's a priest," said Bethan, "I want it done properly."
"Oh, that's very important," said Two Flower seriously. "If there were more morals about, we wouldn't be crashing into stars." They considered this for a moment. Then Two Flower said brightly, "This calls for a celebration. I've got some biscuits and water if you've still got some of that jerky."
"Oh, good," said Rincewind weakly.
He beckoned Cohen to one side. With his beard trimmed, the old man could easily have passed for 70 on a dark night.
"This is serious," he said. "You're really going to marry her?" "Sure thing."